This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. You're listening to WGN Radio. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. I'm John Williams. Michael Miller's an associate professor of economics at DePaul University and a frequent guest on this show. Welcome back, Michael.
It's great to be with you, John.
721 up on the Dow right now, plus 721. NASDAQ up plus 130. Up and down, up and down, up and down these days. But a nice day, it looks like, on the markets, huh?
Yeah, it does. You know, that ultimately, the market price is based upon information and how that information is then run through your analysis, either intellectually or emotionally. And I think what we're seeing is a little bit of both intellectual information on profitability of firms and then emotions based upon things like Omicron. And it changes people's willingness to invest in the future. And I know we don't know exactly what's going to come next, so you move away. And it's fun to watch. I'm just, most of us, though, we just sit by and let it happen.
When we see the market move, though, based on emotional reactions like that, hey, I don't know if the economy is going to be so good, if this new variant is strong. It looks like it's not going to be a terrible variant, but who knows? So I'm going to pull out of the market, or maybe let's leave it there. Do individuals actually do that today, yesterday, the day before, or is that institutional investors who are moving vast sums of money?
A lot of it is institutional because that's where the real money is. There are people, of course, who believe they can time the market. I'm not one who believes that at all. So they get out and get in when they think they know exactly when the market is going to change directions. But, you know, the one thing is when you trade based upon emotions, you oftentimes end up selling at and low and buying when high. So when everybody else is buying, you go buy and high. And then when everybody else is getting out, instead of just riding it through, people will sell low. And that's why emotional investing is something that is done, but it has to be, you have to be careful not to let it take over your investment strategy.
Well, my vision in the rear view mirror, Michael, is 2020. And last week, knowing that this variant wasn't going to be that bad, it's quite infectious, but it's not real deleterious, I knew that the market was going to bounce back up today, but I didn't do anything about it.
So, no, of course not. Yeah. Good for you. I'm glad to hear that because you could have been, who knows, what else could have happened over the weekend? Something happening. You know, we now have Russia and Ukraine. We have China, and these are going to create emotional responses in terms of international politics. And there's just so many things going on. That's why buy and hold has always been my philosophy.
Speaking of, processing things through our own filters, you actually looked at those disappointing quote-unquote jobs numbers and thought they weren't too bad last week.
Yeah, you know, I often try to tell people when I'm interviewed that I'm an economist first and a conservative Republican second, and I'm kind of disappointed. I read a lot of media from both sides. I'm a big fan of Real Clear Politics, which kind of brings you everything. And I was very disturbed or upset that so many publications and analysis on the right, my side, were saying how bad the numbers are. And it was essentially based on this idea that economists and analysts oftentimes will be asked in the days before the data come out, what do you think is going to happen? What do you think the numbers are going to be? Well, those are nothing but guesses. Those aren't facts. Those aren't, except for if somebody invests upon it, It is completely unimportant. All that matters is what comes out. So I did see a fair number of people that said, whoa, what a disappointing labor report. It was disappointing because they were expecting something greater, but they had no idea if it was going to be good or bad. And you have to think of it this way. We're essentially at full employment. You can't beat that. Participation rate is rising. You can't beat that. The number of jobs being created is sufficient to absorb all new entrants and keep unemployment the same. And there's nothing wrong with that. And we see that wages went up, maybe not as fast as they did in the earlier part of the year, but wages went up a little bit. And we even look, you know, the highest unemployment among racial groups is Black unemployment, and Black unemployment fell more than the other racial categories. So when you look at this report, I just don't understand what's bad about it. I think it's a wonderful report. I think it shows a labor market that is in solid condition.
maybe characterizing the numbers, your point notwithstanding, it was less than we thought, but maybe that characterization is somebody making political hay, too, just trying to...
Oh, absolutely. I know it's political. And by the way, it goes both ways. When Mr. Trump was president, there were things that were said by the Democrats, which I thought, are you looking at the same numbers that I am? Because we do remember, for example, right before the pandemic started, we had, I think, in many, to an analyst, maybe the greatest economy in the past 50 years in terms of low unemployment, low inflation, increases in wages and so forth. Mm-hmm. It was an ideal position. But there are many analysts who are blinded by their politics who would say that that simply didn't exist. So it happens on both sides, but I'm very much disappointed when it happens on my side because I want to try to be better than that, to say, let's look at the economy through intellectual eyes, not political eyes.
Let's also look at spending and who was spending and who was not spending in just a minute. We're talking to Michael Miller, Associate Professor of Economics over at DePaul. Talk to me a little bit about the Boston Fed and their report on spending during the pandemic. What were the takeaways there?
Yeah, there were some interesting takeaways, at least in my mind. You know, we have gathered more and more data, and now we have the statistical ability to analyze it in a very disaggregated way. We used to only look at spending in the most aggregated way of just how many dollars. But now we can actually break it down by race, and even if you do it by region and you know something about the politics, we can do it by political background. So the Fed wanted to know, or these guys at the Fed wanted to know, were there any differences in spending based upon, say, race or politics, or and what might explain that difference? And they did find some interesting differences. They found, for example, that if you were to compare Democrats and Republicans, that Republicans had a smaller drop in spending during COVID than Democrats did. And puzzling, you know, they were trying to figure out what in the world could explain this. And it essentially comes down to what they refer to as simply social distancing, that if people are not afraid to go out or they live in states where they are not going to put on as many mandates, people will continue to behave the same way. And a lot of the states that did not have the onerous controls on behavior mm-hmm. were Republican states. Mm-hmm. So we see that the Republicans had a decline which was smaller than Democrats. And no surprising then, or not surprising then, you would find that urban spending declined more than rural spending. And of course, in many cases, rural is equated with Republican. And so we see that that's the case. What was interesting is that there was a drop in Hispanic and college educated that were dominant patterns that they were able to see that, you know, it's more predictive. If you told me that a group of people were Hispanic, I would guess then that their spending would have fallen more than a group of people who were, say, black or white. And so I'm not sure it means anything other than it's very interesting that there does seem to be this a philosophy regarding should I or should I not social distance? And do I then change my behavior? And when I change my behavior, I do change my spending. So it was interesting to see that the social distancing did have an effect upon people's financial situation.
Well, it was hard to spend money in Chicago last year because our Democrat governor decided that we would crush the virus first and then repair the economy later. Other states, Florida, for instance, had very different attitudes about that. It's easy, though, to draw conclusions from that. Like, say, take the college-educated people. You could say, well, college-educated people better appreciated the science of the pandemic and therefore chose to rein their spending in as opposed to, I'm just making this up as I go.
Sure. But see, that's what an economist or an analyst would do. They'd have to figure out, now, what might explain this kind of behavior? And I think what you're pointing at makes perfect sense.
Yeah, although it is kind of the tail wagging the dog. I mean, I'm just taking the results and now saying, okay, I'll bet this is what caused it, but it could have been something else. I don't know.
Oh, sure.
And in fact, if I may, it's very intriguing, these things you're pointing out. Here's the stereotype that in large Democrat cities where you have huddled urban masses who suffer all kinds of economic disparity and disadvantage, I would imagine Democrats tend to have less money to spend than Republicans. I don't know if that's true. Do we know, do Republicans pre or post pandemic have more money generally than Democrats?
I've not seen the data, John. I couldn't tell you which way, either way.
Get back to me on that, will you? I'm here all the week.
Yeah. Okay. I actually enjoy looking up things like that, so I'll see if I can.
In the meantime, talk to me about housing and what we've learned as well.
You know, when we were talking during the pandemic about policy of the federal government, the key was to target the assistance, to make sure it went to the people who needed it the most. And one of the big problems, of course, we had was the housing situation, that people lost jobs almost at the request of the government to stop working, but they still had to pay their rent. So the question becomes, how do you support or how do you help those people? Do you create an eviction moratorium? Do you give the money to the renter and say, now use this money to meet your needs, but also pay your rent? And it turns out that the research is beginning to show us that the most efficient way to help the housing market, to maximize the probability that people will not become homeless, is to essentially pay the landlord directly on behalf of the renter. And what happens then is that the renter does not go further into debt, in that they don't have money right now, but that rent that they haven't paid keeps piling up and piling up, and they have to come up with many thousands. And at the same time, you give the landlord the money that they need to meet their expenses. They have to pay their own mortgages and pay taxes and expenses and upkeep of the shop. So it turns out that it would be an expensive alternative in the short run. But the authors of the paper essentially were saying, you know, over time, this is probably the better solution, because it will not lead to an increase in, say, the rents in general, nor will it lead to a reduction in the supply of rental units, if landlords know, of course, that they can be assured that they will be paid. So it's almost like a win-win situation. The renter does not go further in debt. The landlord can keep the housing unit on the market. It's expensive, again, but if our desire is to deal with homelessness and try to minimize the effect of the pandemic, this seems to be the most efficient way to do it.
Pay the landlord directly. Michael Miller, Associate Professor of Economics over at DePaul. What a pleasure, Michael. Thanks again. We always enjoy your time with us.
That's great, John. Talk to you next time.
Yeah, you betcha. Now, on Mondays, we usually speak with Jim Dahlke, and today is no exception. Jim, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Hey, John. Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Jim's the senior editor at ChicagoInno.com. We talk tech stories in Chicago. Everybody last week was talking about the Home Alone house in Winnetka on Airbnb. What's your takeaway from all the attention that thing got?
You know, it's funny. Airbnb loves to do this. It's not the first sort of celebrity house or sort of well-known TV and film home that they've put up there. You know, Airbnb has also let you stay in the Downton Abbey house, the Golden Girls guest house. It wasn't too long ago they were opening up Scottie Pippen's old house to let you watch the Summer Olympics. And so a little bit of a promo gimmick for Airbnb here. But man, I wouldn't mind staying a night in the old Home Alone house. That house looks pretty cool. And you know, tis the season, right? And at only $25, it's pretty affordable too.
Yeah, it was always confusing me. I guess the whole thing is just a loss leader for them, right? I mean, you don't make any money on it, and only one, they only charge it once. They don't do it all month. So it's just reminding people that they're out there, huh?
Yeah, a little bit of earned media here from Airbnb. But yeah, I mean, I'm curious to kind of see their strategy of this going forward. And I imagine there's a lot of opportunities for some famous homes to come on the market here. So we'll see. But yeah, the booking begins tomorrow, actually at 1 p.m. So some lucky bookers will be able to get their place here on December 12th.
I wonder if somebody's made a list of, okay, what are the other Chicago properties that you would like to Airbnb-ize for a day, like while you were sleeping home? You know, there's a lot of famous scenes, but those aren't homes. We're talking homes and apartments here, right?
Well, the old Michael Jordan house that was on the market for forever, that's got to be up there. Yeah. You know, the old 23 on the gates out front.
Yeah. That house was ridiculous. It was ridiculous. I mean, I guess if you have that much money, you get to spend that much money, but yeah, it was a campus, and then he wasn't even living there at the end, right? His wife was living there, but Michael wasn't. I'd take maybe one of Oprah's penthouse suites, maybe one of the infamous suites in the Trump Hotel. I mean, you could market the notoriety of some of these places as well as the celebrity of them. Do that article for me, okay, will you, Jim?
You got it, John.
Tesla and Chicago's Radio Flyer make a Cybertruck for kids. I think Steve Alexander may have reported on this, too. What's going on here?
Yeah, you might be waiting for the real adult version of the Cybertruck, which is supposedly coming next year, but some lucky shoppers were able to get a miniature version for their kids. So Tesla and Radio Flyer came out with a 8-and-up version of the Cybertruck called the Cyber Quad. It's essentially a battery-powered ATV. I think it can go 10 miles an hour and retails for $1,900. Was available for purchase starting last week. Already sold out on Tesla's website, as many of their sort of other products tend to do, right? Go off sale very quickly. But this is a partnership that really began back in 2016. Radio Flyer teamed up with Tesla back then to create a lithium ion battery powered Tesla Model S toy car. And have really actually used that same battery to power a range of different products, including their adult products. They came out with an electric bike and scooter product last year, which was their very first product made just for adults, which is based on that same battery.
I'm a little surprised. I guess I shouldn't be. I love the company. I love the CEO. They've been guests of ours. And my granddaughter is pushing around a Radio Flyer walker toy for kids, which brings joy to our family like we've never known. So it's all good. But it would seem to me like the Radio Flyer brand is more exercise and outdoors and toys and not electronics, you know, going in that direction. So I guess whatever works, huh?
Yeah, it is an interesting partnership between the two of them. But, you know, I think that they see an opportunity to kind of plug into Tesla's rabid fan base, right? So maybe, if, you know, Tesla's fans aren't super familiar with Radio Flyer, and so, you know, they get to kind of open up to a whole new fan base there, and you know, from everything from the Model S to the Cybertruck. And check it out at chicagoeno.com. I got some pictures of it on our site, and it's got a very similar look to the Cybertruck too. It's a pretty cool little ATV.
You posted a story today about the Shark Tank startup Luminade. What did you write there?
Yeah, so Luminade, a Chicago business, launched back in 2010. They were on Shark Tank in 2015. Actually got a deal from Mark Cuban, $200,000 for 15% of their company. But recently were acquired. So they've been purchased by Adventure Ready Brands. That's a New Hampshire company. It's been around for a bunch of years. They make outdoor gear and products, sort of best known perhaps for Afterbite, the bug bite repellent that they've made. Luminade, now an acquired business. It has, you know, really gained popularity both on that Shark Tank episode and also showing up in natural disasters. They make a lantern that's solar powered, can charge your phone, and has really been used after hurricanes and other kind of natural disasters, and has really come in handy for a lot of folks in need.
You also wrote about an interesting startup called Print With Me and how they've expanded there. I'm out of time here, but we'll remind our listeners that these and other stories are found each and every day at chicagoeno.com. Jim Dahlke's a senior editor. Nice to talk to you, Jim. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks, John.
12:44 on the Wintrust Business Lunch. More business news with Dave Schwann.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago gas prices have fallen 4.4 cents per gallon in the past week. Gas Buddy reports an average price of $3.62, a little over 10 cents per gallon less than a month ago. The cheapest price in the city, $2.99. Some business economists have raised their forecast for inflation due in large part to bottlenecked supply chains. The National Association for Business Economics found its panel expects consumer prices to rise 6% this quarter. That's your Wintrust Business Minute. I'm Dave Schwann.
Steve, I'm wondering if we're going to get to 401k, like Terry Savage and Dr. Bob have said. We need more 700-point days. What are we at now on the Dow, then?
We got 35,326.
Got a ways to go still.
Yeah.
Why don't you do the business of food, sir?
Okay, food for thought, Johnny. Mr. Fizz is back to talk about Christmas trees. A Christmas tree is that's a big industry in Illinois across the Midwest, as most of the trees on the lots here come from tree farms around the Midwest. And when you're in the tree lots selecting a tree, are you supposed to pound them on the ground to see how many needles fall off? I posed that question to Mr. Fizz.
You can do that, and you will get a few needles that fall off because they shed all year round, but the ones that really shed heavily are ones that you do not want. We are really fond of the Fraser fir. There are other firs. These trees keep their needles very well, and they can be trimmed to beautiful shapes. The pines are still popular. The Scotch pine is too stiff for ornaments as far as I'm concerned. The white pines are too floppy for ornaments, although they're gorgeous trees. And the spruce trees, there's another problem with the losing of the needles. These trees were cut in October, so when you get it in the water, as soon as you do, cut the tip of the stem off about an inch or so, put it in the water and send into your tree stand as soon as you can. Make sure your stand stays full of water. And these will last easily from now until Christmas. In fact, Fraser firs will last a month indoors if you take good care of them.
Should we be putting something into the water, like the powder that comes with fresh-cut flowers, or sugar or something?
You know, that's a good question. Actually, the thing these trees really need is water. And if you cut the tip of the stem off to prevent growing of bacteria and so forth in the water and keep the water fresh, there should be no problem. The other thing I want to mention is the trees are flammable. So you want to be sure that you put lights on there that are in good shape. If you suspect that they're not in good shape, throw them away and get new ones to put on. And don't leave your lights on when you're gone or when you're sleeping. And as soon as the tree gets to be dry, you need to take it out. The dry trees can burn very quickly. We hate to think about that, but every once in a while we'll hear that somebody had a tree that caught fire and burned up a piece of the house. We hope that never happens to anybody that's listening, and we hope that everybody has an enjoyable time with their Christmas trees and that they enjoy Christmas as well.
Thank you, Mr. Fizz, and the same to you, sir. Jim Fizzell, our gardening guru. Pretty quiet day at the Chicago Board of Trade today. Corn is now down about 3 cents, beans are down 7, and wheat is up a penny. From the farm to your belly, today is National Gazpacho Day. And if cold soup isn't your thing, it's also National Microwave Oven Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Jamie Guth joins us now. Let's talk about travel today. I'm seeing some scrolls on TV about Omicron. What's the story here, Amy?
Yeah, certainly. So I very closely watch the airline industry, particularly United Airlines and Boeing, since they're right here based in Chicago. So I've been kind of taking a look at the very rapidly changing rules around flights right now due to the new variant. And so essentially, starting today, the new requirement is that all inbound U.S. travelers need to show a negative COVID test result the day before departure. So whether you're a citizen, whether you're vaccinated, whatever, if you're coming here, you need to show a negative COVID test. There is a voluntary testing option for some airports. If you're flying to JFK or Newark or San Francisco, a couple of others, there's voluntary testing that you can do at the airport, just to help the CDC kind of track and see where the virus is and is not. Again, that's totally voluntary. But what is important is you cannot board a flight bound for the U.S. without that negative COVID test. Now, there's also a lot of airlines are changing their flight change rules. So Delta has waived fare differences for Japan and Israel that both have temporarily banned foreign visitors. And for South Africa, if you fly before December 12th, American has made changes basically about anywhere you're flying. I mean, the list is pretty long. If you're flying up until New Year's Eve, you can switch that ticket and use it anytime before New Year's Eve of 2022. So you can use it anytime next year. So what we've seen is about 3% of flights. So that's about 151,000 flights globally between now and February 1st have been tweaked a little bit. So we're starting to see some carriers cut their flight schedule that's already not quite up at pre-pandemic levels. It was getting close. There was a lot of optimism in the airline industry around this big recovery. And of course, now this variant has changed that and introduced a lot of uncertainty into the equation when a lot of people were perhaps counting on traveling for the holidays. So, you know, the best advice I could give there is to, you know, check in with your carrier, make sure that you have budgeted for time and expense if you are going to be required to take a COVID test for where you're going. And if you're not, give the airline a call. I know we do most of our travel stuff online, but your best bet really is to give the carrier a call and just see what your options are as things are kind of shifting pretty quickly and more restrictions are expected from other countries. So particularly if you're flying internationally. Now, if you're driving to Canada or Mexico right now, that COVID testing requirement does not exist for land travel. That's just for air travel right now. That could change, but that's where that is for today.
We traveled from Europe back to the United States this fall. We had 72 hours, not 24. It's more stringent that way. The costs were, depending on where people got them, anywhere from €25 to €70 for that quick turnaround on that test, that relatively quick turnaround on that test. So what does this do to the industry overall then? What's happening?
Yeah, so I think it's interesting that, you know, Bloomberg was reporting on this a little bit and talking to some industry watchers about that number of the flights that are starting to be cut. So really looking at that, it's still a pretty small margin, but here's all these carriers that were just kind of ramping back up. So their hesitancy to, you know, make any bigger cuts, I think that there's probably just kind of a wait and see sort of feeling going. But there has been a little bit of call for a very unified approach to that. The CEO of Star Alliance, that's United, Singapore Airlines, Air China, a bunch of others, about 26 different carriers. You know, he said Omicron just brings to the fore that we're not as coordinated as we should be. So he's really calling for, let's all get together and be on the same page, so it's not quite as stressful for travelers and it's not quite as financially impactful to airlines. Because if there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of what we found in the last wave when we saw the Delta variant impacting travel was it was so difficult for people to navigate that they just wouldn't fly, right? Some people were just kind of going, you know what, it's not worth it. It's too much drama right now. So I think for Star Alliance and airline leadership to be kind of touting this idea of let's all get on the same page and have this unified approach, that to me says they're probably trying to strategize about preserving some revenue and keeping options open for people to fly. You know, international travel was such the biggest part of that. That's such a high dollar, that's such a big revenue driver for airlines outside of business travel, because business travel is usually done, it's a last minute ticket, so it's usually a higher amount. So international travel, I think, is what a lot of airlines were really counting on. A lot of them were talking about how important it will be to open up those longer haul flights. So this changes that. But we will see how the airlines respond differently this time as opposed to when things very quickly shifted at the emergence of the Delta variant.
30 seconds, Amy. What's the DoorDash story today?
Yeah, so DoorDash is coming out with this new thing. They're testing it in New York because it's very dense population there, but it's a 10 to 15 minute delivery. That's a quick turnaround right there. So it's this new service. It's called DashMart. So if you're using DoorDash, you might get this tab in your order in the app that says convenience. And that would be, you know, the way you could get things a little faster. They're trying to compete in that space of things like GoPuff, Gorillas, and Fridge No More that are, you know, stocking up heavily in major cities to try to reduce delivery time. They're trying to get into that space. So, but they said, we're going to test it in New York, see how it goes, and with the intention of rolling it out to other major metro areas. So that may be coming to Chicago sooner than later.
Amy, we'll visit later in the week. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thanks so much.